This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Stephen Rohde, who is active in the Los Angeles branch of Assange Defense. The issue of the extradition of Julian Assange is one of the topics that Joe Biden and the Prime Minister of Australia discussed in high-level talks last week.
We take a look at deepfakes. Those are artificial intelligence-generated fake videos, and many of them are pornographic.
We'll be joined by Texas criminal defense attorney Nick Toufexis and the work he is doing to monitor this development and protect victims of deepfake porn.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was in Washington last week meeting with Joe Biden. They are discussing AUKUS, the Trilateral Security Alliance between the U.S., the U.K., and Australia, which is a bulwark against the perceived threat from China. AUKUS seeks to transfer U.S. and British nuclear submarine technology to Australia. But Australia's support for a potential U.S. war against China over Taiwan, which China considers part of China, is not a foregone conclusion. Also reportedly on the agenda for the high-level meeting is the U.S. request for extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is an Australian citizen. Assange has been held for 4 years in a high-security London prison. He is facing 175 years in prison if extradited, tried, and convicted in the U.S. for charges under the Espionage Act for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes. Albanese and a multi-party coalition of the Australian Parliament, as well as 90% of the Australian population, want the prosecution of Assange dropped. Assange's freedom is widely seen as a test of Australia's leverage with the Biden administration, according to the Associated Press. Here to help us unpack this situation is Stephen Rohde. Steve is an author and social justice advocate who practiced civil rights and constitutional law for more than 45 years, including representing two men on California's death row. He is a founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, former chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, and former national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. Steve is also a board member of Death Penalty Focus and is active in the Los Angeles branch of Assange Defense. He is author of an article published last week by LA Progressive titled, "Is Biden Willing to Damage Relations with a Staunch Ally Like Australia in His Headlong Prosecution of Julian Assange?" Stephen Rohde, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much, Marjorie. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Steve, please explain the evidence of U.S. war crimes that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks exposed in 2010 to 2011.
You know, we can never go over this enough, because in 2010, Chelsea Manning provided WikiLeaks with documents containing evidence of U.S. war crimes. They were roughly in three or four categories. There were the Iraq war logs, which were 400,000 field reports describing 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, as well as systemic and systematic rape, torture, and murder after U.S. forces handed over detainees to the notorious Iraqi torture squad. There was a separate Afghan war diary, 90,000 reports of more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had reported. And there were the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports with evidence from 150 innocent people that had been held at Guantanamo for years, and the 800 men and boys who had been tortured and abused, all of which violated the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment or punishment. Perhaps the most notorious material released and furnished to WikiLeaks was the 2007 collateral murder video, which graphically, to our own eyes, shows a U.S. Army Apache attack helicopter targeting and killing 11 unarmed civilians, including two Reuters journalists, as well as a man who came to rescue the wounded. Two children were injured. The video reveals evidence of three separate violations of the Geneva Convention and the U.S. Army Field Manual. To briefly describe these documents is to demonstrate the compelling public service that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange render to the world, and yet he wallows in prison.
Last November, the New York Times, Le Monde, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, and El País signed a joint open letter urging the U.S. government to dismiss the Espionage Act charges against Assange for publishing classified military and diplomatic secrets. Publishing is not a crime, the letter says. Those five media outlets, like WikiLeaks, published evidence of Cablegate. What does that refer to?
Cablegate was another set of 251,000 confidential cables from the U.S. State Department that disclosed corruption, diplomatic scandals, spy affairs on an international scale. According to the New York Times itself, the documents told, quote, the unvarnished story of how the government makes its biggest decisions, the decisions that cost the country most heavily in lives and money.
Steve, the indictment against Assange was filed by the Trump administration. The Obama administration, which had indicted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior administrations combined, refused to indict Assange because of the so-called New York Times problem. Please explain to our listeners what that is.
The New York Times problem encapsulates the conflict which the Assange indictment reflects, because it was the New York Times and several other publications which published the material that WikiLeaks made available to indict WikiLeaks and not to indict the New York Times and these other publications reveals the hypocrisy of the prosecution itself. This is the first time that a publisher has been prosecuted under the nefarious Espionage Act of 1917 for disclosing government secrets. The Obama administration and its Justice Department studied the issue, understood these dilemmas, understood the First Amendment challenge that they would face, and they declined to indict Julian Assange. And it was only when Trump wanted to look tough on the press that he went after Assange.
Steve, instead of dismissing the indictment against Assange, the Biden administration is vigorously seeking his extradition and prosecution in the United States. Why do you think Biden is continuing the persecution of Assange?
Frankly, it's baffling It's baffling from a constitutional standpoint. It's baffling from even a political standpoint. As we'll discuss in a moment, the initial decision in England was not to extradite Julian Assange. Just as Biden came to office, he had every reason to accept that decision. Instead, in some kind of law and order tip of the hat to the forces against the press, he has authorized and Merrick Garland has used the resources of the Department of Justice to vigorously challenge the decision not to extradite Julian Assange. It's really a shameful decision. It's hypocritical also because only recently Biden at the White House correspondents' dinner said that journalism is not a crime. And then instead, out of the other side of his administration, he can be seeking to make it a crime. I think all pressure needs to be put on Biden and the Department of Justice to drop this prosecution.
What did Assange do that investigative journalists routinely do in their work? And what would be the First Amendment repercussions if Assange is convicted and imprisoned under the Espionage Act?
Well, Assange and WikiLeaks did what Seymour Hersh and other award-winning journalists have done at one level or another throughout the history of the United States and in the modern era. They released leaked information about government wrongdoing. This has a tremendously chilling effect on the press. The Washington Post executive editor Marty Baron said that the Assange indictment undermines the very purpose of the First Amendment. And the USA Today editor-in-chief, Nicole Carroll, has called it a chilling attack on press freedom and the public's right to know. These are the very acts of securing leaked information, of cultivating relationships with sources, of vetting and revealing that information. It's at the heart of investigative journalism. And it's really no exaggeration to say that the extradition, trial, and prosecution and conviction of Julian Assange would send a terrible message across not only American journalism, but journalism across the world. This form of disclosure, this form of unearthing government wrongdoing can end up putting you in jail. That is a terrifying prospect.
In January of 2021, UK District Judge Vanessa Baratzer denied the Biden administration's request for extradition. What were her findings?
She examined the case, and she found that given the fact that Assange had been confined in the Ecuadorian embassy for 7 years, and by then had been held in the Balmarsh High Security Prison since April 12, 2019, she found that his mental condition, quote, is such that it would be oppressive to extradite him to the United States of America. She made a series of findings to support that conclusion. She used only the wing of the argument against extradition that was based on humanitarian grounds and the risk to Assange's life and health that would occur if he was released. Those were factual findings. There was tremendous evidence presented at the extradition hearings to support those findings, and although she turned back other grounds, which we'll talk about, those grounds were in and of themselves sufficient to deny extradition, and frankly, the case should have ended there.
So didn't Baratzer make a finding that it was very likely that if Assange were extradited and imprisoned in the United States in one of the supermax prisons held in solitary confinement, that he was a very high risk for suicide?
That's quite correct. She went that far, and she had a strong evidentiary basis. The Assange team in England has been doing an extraordinary job. They took the extradition hearings very seriously. They put on top-flight expert witnesses in order to build a factual case rather than just allegations. And that's exactly what Judge Baratzer relied on.
So after the U.S. Justice Department came forward with so-called assurances that Assange wouldn't be held in harsh prison conditions if extradited to the U.S., the U.K. High Court reversed Baratzer's denial of extradition, and Assange's appeal is now pending. What issues is he raising, and what can he do if the U.K. High Court denies his request to appeal?
Yes, it's very important for our audience and any supporters of free press and journalism to take note of the current appeal. Initially, back in June, British judge Sir Jonathan Swift, in a cursory 3-page denial, rejected Assange's appeal. That judge provided really no analysis in light of the 150-page submission. So now it goes to a higher panel, and there are 4 basic issues to streamline the conversation. The UK-US extradition treaty prohibits extradition for political offenses. Very specifically, it provides that extradition shall not be granted if the offense for which extradition is requested is a political offense. Now, espionage at its very heart is a pure political offense. It's an offense against the state. And as the Assange legal team has written, quote, the gravamen and defining legal characteristic of each of the charges against Assange is thus an alleged intention to obtain or disclose U.S. state secrets in a manner that was damaging to the security of the U.S. state, which makes them political offenses. The second ground is that the extradition request was made for ulterior political motives and not in good faith. This is a separate ground from the political offense ground. And so lawyers are arguing that this is a unprecedented selective prosecution focusing on leaked national security information, and it speaks directly to the political character of the prosecution. Here, Assange's lawyers, I think, have written piercingly and eloquently, quote, this prosecution is motivated by matters other than the proper and usual pursuit of criminal justice. It is motivated instead by a concerted intent to destroy or inhibit the publishers of evidence of state criminal ability and thereby put a stop to the process of investigating, prosecuting, and preventing such international crimes in the future. I want to add that the appeal papers point out that Assange is being prosecuted for exposing, quote, wholesale abuse and war crimes committed by the U.S., and they make an interesting point here in their appeal. If instead he had been exposing war crimes or crimes against humanity committed by a state such as the Russian Federation, there could be no doubt that his prosecution for such a revelation would be regarded in both a political offense and an impermissible prosecution motivated by the desire to punish him for political opinions and acts. The third ground is that extradition would violate freedom of expression, which is guaranteed by the European Convention on Human Rights. That convention specifically protects freedom of expression. And here, they're supported both at the extradition hearing and in their briefs by Columbia Law Professor Jamil Jaffer, who testified that the indictment is focused almost entirely on things that national security journalists do routinely and as a necessary part of their work, the kinds of things we mentioned before, cultivating sources, communicating with them confidentially, soliciting information from them, protecting their identities, and publishing classified information. Finally, there's new evidence that was not considered by the district judge. The European Convention protects the right to life, forbids torture and cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. The appeal renews the notion that there's a real risk of violation because in September of 2021, a Yahoo News report revealed that while Assange was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London under a grant of asylum, a senior CIA and Trump administration officials asked for, quote, sketches or, quote, options to assassinate Julian Assange. Trump himself asked whether the CIA could assassinate Assange and provided and asked for options to do so. So the legal brief argues that if these state agencies were prepared to go to those lengths while he was under the protection of an embassy located outside the United States, there's real risk of similar extrajudicial measures or reprisals if he's extradited to the U.S. Now, if these grounds fail in the highest courts in the U.K., Assange does have the right to appeal to the European Court on Human Rights. But frankly, those have been viewed by England and other European countries as advisory, and there's no guarantee that even if there's a full-dress decision by the European Court, that England will respect it, and we could still be facing Assange's extradition.
Steve, how could the issue of Assange's freedom impact the talks between Biden and Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia?
The Australian government, officially, and the Australian people are taking the attempted prosecution of Assange very seriously. They have spoken out on this. Polling shows that they are opposed to the prosecution. As a consequence, these talks are very important to put on the table, to confront Biden face to face with all the important issues that I'm sure Albanese and Biden discuss. But this is very important because if a foreign national in a foreign country reporting on international news can be dragged to the United States and forced to stand trial on U.S. charges, this sets a very dangerous precedent, so that not only on its merits viewed as a separate prosecution, but the precedent of doing so is very dangerous. It really poses a major threat. It poses a risk to journalists that have been seized and held elsewhere. And as a consequence, I think it will be a major aspect of these discussions.
Steve, what can our listeners do to pressure Biden and the Department of Justice to drop the extradition and dismiss the indictment against Assange?
Everyone listening to this show, and by extension to your colleagues, should contact the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland, and directly explain your opposition and the reasons why this violates the First Amendment and should not be a prosecution by the U.S. You can contact Merrick Garland directly at the Department of Justice, and you can contact the White House. More importantly, there is currently a letter being circulated in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate by Thomas Massie and James McGovern. You can call the Congress at 1-202-224-3121, and you can call on President Biden and call on your senators and representatives, I should say, to join in that letter, which is already gathering many signatures. And you can always go to www.assangedefense.org for updates and current calls to action.
Well, Steve Rohde, thank you so much for your work in support of Julian Assange. And full disclosure, I work with you on Assange Defense. And thank you for joining us once again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for this and for all you do, Marjorie, on human rights and civil liberties.
Thanks, Steve.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Hey, y'all, I got a story I want to tell somebody. In my life I've seen a lot of things go. I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right, trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind, but I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you would do until you're put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester.
Across 110th Street,
pushing won't let a junkie go free.
Across 110th Street.
Artificial intelligence-generated fake videos, known as deepfakes, have become increasingly prevalent and increasingly sophisticated. The technology manipulates both audio and visual elements to fabricate fictitious events. In 2019, the AI firm DeepTrace identified a total of 15,000 deepfake videos online. Shockingly, 96% of these were pornographic, with 99% involving the superimposition of female celebrities' faces onto pornographic content. That's known as face swap pornography, and it's done without celebrities' consent. But it's important to note that non-celebrities are also frequent targets of deepfake abuse. Especially concerning is the fact that women are often singled out, with AI tools and apps readily available that enable users to digitally remove clothing from their photos or insert their faces into explicit videos. These tools are easily accessible and require no specialized technical skills. Equally troubling is the fact that most of the time, the women who are deepfake targets are neither aware of nor consent to their images being used in this way. Social media platforms have become fertile ground for deepfake scams. Deepfakes are used for various malicious purposes, including gaining a political advantage, spreading fake news, and disseminating revenge porn. In the case of pornographic videos, offenders may use deepfakes to groom, harass, or extort their victims. Additionally, deepfakes can be used to bully individuals or steal their identities. It's worth noting that although AI-generated deepfakes can appear highly realistic, most of them exhibit certain inconsistencies. These may manifest as peculiar facial features, awkward placements, or unnatural postures and movements. Creating deepfakes is a time-consuming and labor-intensive process, so most of them are relatively short in duration. The prevalence of deepfakes has grown significantly, more than doubling between 2022 and the first quarter of 2023. In response to this trend, the FBI issued a warning in 2023 about sextortion schemes, in which criminals collect photos and videos from social media platforms to produce sexually themed deepfakes, which they then use to extort money from their victims. Joining us today to talk about the impact of deepfake pornography on victims and the current state of the law governing these videos is criminal defense attorney Nicholas Tufexis. Nick is a partner in the Texas law firm Saputo Tufexis Criminal Defense. Nicholas, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in this particular issue?
Yeah, so my law firm, Saputo Tufexis, regularly follows and publishes information about criminal offenses in Texas and federal stuff as well. And this law is a new and very hot topic. We were really interested in, you know, what the law was about.
Nick, what is deepfake porn, and how does someone create it?
Yeah, absolutely. So generally speaking, deepfake porn is when someone takes a pornographic video and puts your face on one of the bodies in that video and make it look convincingly like you. So what they do is they're basically taking a photo of you, and it can be just any photo, and they're using that image, and they put it on the face of the body within that pornographic video. And the way that they're able to smooth it and make it look, it really does look like it's you performing the act in the video, and it's very hard to spot the difference between the actual video and the deepfake video.
And you know, Nick, I was just talking to a friend about this. So many families post photos of their teenage or even younger children on social media. And I understand that a lot of the creators of this deepfake pornography will take images, for example, of a young girl that the family is sharing widely, maybe without adequate privacy protections and unknowingly. And that is how some of these are created.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then that's part of the issue with this is that just because you're putting out a photo, and then a photo that is totally innocuous, and you're just trying to share it with your family and friends, people are able to take that photo and do these types of things with it. And it's a real problem. I mean, that's why a big portion, and you know, they're talking about it all over the place, is privacy on the internet and making sure your privacy settings are correct and making sure that your information is not being disseminated far and wide because things like this are happening.
I want to add that people know about fake political online videos and whatnot. We're hearing a lot about that. But deepfakes in porn actually make up the vast number of fake online videos. Can you explain how they are used? And I think there are different ways they're used to extort victims.
Yeah, so a deepfake video is essentially like falsified evidence. You know, people use that saying, and I'm sure you guys have heard it before, you know, seeing is believing. You know, and a skilled deepfake creator can make it look, make the purest nun look like they're engaged in the most vile sex acts. And they'll tell you, hey, if you don't pay, I'm going to release this to the public. People are going to be convinced because it's really hard to spot the difference. And so that's one of the ways that they're really using these videos to extort people. Is there, hey, look what I've created. No one's going to believe you. And so if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, then I'm going to release it to the public.
Nick, we know that before the 2020 election, Facebook banned deepfake videos that could or are likely to mislead viewers into thinking someone said words they did not actually say. Are there similar efforts on social media platforms now that are trying to crack down on these deep fake porns?
Yeah, I think that there are. You know, as you said, Facebook has, and I think it's more platform to platform, however, of whether or not they want to be the regulator or if they want the community to self-regulate. You know, porn is kind of, on social media, it's not really something that's allowed all, you know, far and wide. And there's a lot of efforts, especially the one that comes to mind with the political stuff was the Nancy Pelosi video. I know that I saw it when it first came out, and this was when deepfakes first happened, and it was very convincing for me. You know, so I know that the lot of platforms are, but again, I think it's going to be platform to platform. We see with X, under new ownership, and you know, they're kind of more leaning towards a more community-based regulation approach. So I think we're going to have to see what everybody wants to do. But I think far and wide, you know, there is a lot of, they know about this issue and they're trying to do something about it.
And we should explain, if listeners aren't familiar with that Pelosi video, that it was doctored to make, I think her speech was slowed down. It made her appear that she was inebriated, and apparently it was widely seen.
Yes, yeah, it was one of the things that went viral. And people didn't know that it was fake. I mean, and that, again, that's why this is such an issue, is because someone puts out a video like that and, you know, everybody sees it and they're like, well, I saw her do that. And it was actually a falsified video. So that was really what sparked a lot of people to start doing that regulation.
We'll be getting to some of the legal aspects in a minute. But Nick, can you talk about what being a victim of a deep fake porn video, how that can negatively impact someone and their family?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a video like this being released is reputation destroying. I mean, this is like being falsely accused of a crime, but it's even worse here. You know, the principle of innocent until proven guilty is out the window in a court of public opinion when you see someone on video actually doing it, even when it isn't real. You know, people see things, they tend to make decisions really quickly. I mean, we see that all the time with stuff, and so that's why this is, you know, this could be a very big negative impact for someone.
Nick, is there a technological way to expose a deep fake video so that when someone does see it, there's a way to disprove that it actually happened?
It is all so new. The only way that they're going to be able to prove that is they're going to have to find the video, where it came from and all that stuff. And so that's, you know, that's part of what this all is. It's just so new that really we know it's a problem. They're trying to do something about it. But as far as like seeing it in action, it hasn't really been tried yet.
So do victims of porn deepfakes have any recourse in court?
Yes. So with this new law, it allows them to make a complaint with the police. It allows the police to investigate and make an arrest, and they can be charged with this Class A misdemeanor offense. So they would be, there is some recourse in the criminal side. There could also be a potential for civil damages in a defamation lawsuit. But again, that's all case by case basis. And something they would have to speak to an attorney about.
No matter whether you are being prosecuted or whether you are bringing an action civilly, in order to either defend yourself or prove your claim, you still have to be able to prove that that video is not you. Don't you?
Well, yes. So, I mean, the code section here is 21.165. of the Texas Penal Code, right? And it says that the way that they're going to be going after people for this is that if a person, without the consent of the person appearing to be depicted, produces or distributes by electronic means a deep fake video that appears to depict the person or their intimate parts exposed and engaged in sexual conduct. They're going to have to show that this person did make the deep fake video, and that person is going to have to say that, hey, I wasn't in that video. Now, again, if the person is making the complaint and saying, hey, that video is not me, and they start investigating and they're able to trace where the video came from and see that it's not it's a video of somewhere else, and they're really good about being able to look at videos and see where they came from and stuff like that. They do that with child pornography. They're able to kind of do a lot of stuff like that. Tagging videos is another thing that they like to do. And so they'll be able to, should be able to do that. And I think that's how they're going to be able to find these people who are creating these videos.
So I just want to be clear, in terms of Texas and the legality of deepfakes, Texas, didn't it become the first state in the nation to prohibit the creation or distribution of deepfake videos? I think that's to those that were intended to harm candidates for public office or to influence elections. Does that protect citizens, private citizens as well, from being victimized by deepfake porn videos?
Yeah, so Texas actually has two laws with deepfakes within it. So the one that you're talking about that has about the influencing of elections in public office is the election code. It's 255.004. And this has been on the books since 1987. But in 2019, they added a provision regarding deepfakes and videos. So this law is only going to apply to political candidates. But the new law regarding deepfake pornography is the law that's going to provide protections for citizens who are subject to deepfake pornography videos.
Do you predict any changes in the future legality of deepfake porn in the states, other states, or federally?
Yeah, I mean, I think Texas got this one right. We were one of the first ones to do this. I think Texas is going to be a model for a lot of other states to follow in an attempt to curb this type of behavior. I think we know that nationwide this is an issue. I think a lot of states are going to be taking a look at this law and trying to model it so that they also are giving the protections to people in their states.
Nick, let's talk about your practice. As criminal defense attorneys, I looked at your website briefly, and I understand there would be concerns about individuals who are being accused of creating deep fake porn videos, and they have a right, of course, to a robust defense. Given a lot of the people impacted by deep fake porns are girls and women, has your firm defended a lot of people accused of these, or is it too early in the state of the law?
It's very early in the state of the law. So we haven't seen a lot of this yet. Again, we've done a lot of research on it because it is new and it is a hot button issue that's going around the nation. But we haven't seen a lot of it yet. It's very hard for me to say kind of how these things have gone. But again, it is very, very new still.
So we understand that the state of Texas also recently passed a child grooming law, punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine, even though a federal law is already in the books. What is child grooming, and what is the problem with this law?
So the word grooming is synonymous with a lot of words, such as teaching, coaching, and parenting. And the issue that I think with this law is that the writing of the law is so vague that it makes a lot of innocuous things criminal. It makes it so a parent that it could mean that a parent who is educating their kids about sex could be deemed to be a criminal act. And that's one of the problems that we think is with this law, is that it's just overly vague.
Nick, I just thought of something on a related note about the deepfake porn video law. We're hearing a lot of discussions around the nation in terms of liability of platforms that host certain kinds of content. Does this new law in Texas address liability on the part of the sites that may be hosting this pornography?
So, no, it doesn't. This law does only in both of them, the election code law and the penal code law, they both are only, they're kind of targeted towards the person who is producing or distributing or creating. So the platform that someone posted on didn't do either of those two things. They just happened to have it on their website. And so those people, the platforms are not being targeted as much as the person who is actually creating the content.
You know, I'm imagining too, because I'm also interested in technology cases in defending people who have been accused of tech crimes, and some of the laws seem overly harsh, like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It's dawning on me that with the difficulty of showing how a deepfake was created technologically, I would imagine that defense lawyers may have a challenging time in court presenting all the evidence to a jury who may not really understand technology. Do you see the tech component of all of this as complicating defense of cases in the future?
Yeah, I think tech is already kind of doing that. I think, and that's not just for us. I mean, I think that's for prosecutors as well. I mean, having to prove where something came from, how it got there, how things are transmitted, if you're depending on what you're trying to prove. I mean, most people just don't have that knowledge, and not because they just don't understand it. It's just something they don't come across very often. And so when you're putting jurors in a box and they're now being talked to about a lot of tech and, you know, kind of high level tech stuff, it is a very difficult thing to kind of explain to them. You're having to do it right there in front of them, and they don't even get to ask questions, which makes it a little, even harder. I think that's not just for us. I think that's for prosecutors as well, probably civil cases as well. I've heard my friends are civil attorneys, and they say the same thing. I mean, tech is a hard thing to explain to people, and I think that's not going away anytime soon. I think it's only going to get worse as technology gets better.
Nick, given all of the technological complications with the legal system, I want to ask you, just in general, how can concerned users spot deepfakes, and what can individuals do to protect themselves and their children?
So I'm going to answer these a little bit out of order, just because I think we talked a little bit about this at the beginning. And, again, regulation of privacy settings on social media is probably the top thing that you can do. Like we said, it's very difficult to make it so that no one can get your picture nowadays. Even if you're not taking the picture, someone else might be taking a picture of you, and that's all you need. Security cameras are everywhere. We're on video a lot, everybody in the world. So I think the strongest thing you can do here is just regulate your privacy settings on social media. For parents, it's about monitoring your children's internet presence and what they're posting. That's really all we can do. I mean, unless you're going to just completely go off the grid, which seems very difficult to do, that's really all you can do to protect yourself, is try to regulate as much as you can. As far as spotting the deepfakes, the things you can really look for are strange blinking patterns or no blinking at all, uneven skin tones, lip movements that don't match the words, and inconsistency in details such as their hair, clothes, or jewelry.
Yeah, I will just inject here that I read an article in the New York Times just this past week about parents who are now taking all of their kids' pictures off of their websites, off their Facebook pages, and covering their kids' faces, and it's really daunting.
Yeah, I mean, and it's sad that this is where we're at, but this is where we're at. I think people are starting to get wise to that as well, and are taking those proper precautions, because you just don't know who's out there, and maybe the internet's a big, scary place, unfortunately.
Speaking of that, if someone does find themselves a victim of a deepfake attack, we'll call it, what authorities do they notify? Should they go to the local police, the FBI? Do you have a sort of suggested protocol for that?
Yeah, I think the thing that you should be doing if you do find that you've been a victim of this is that you should report to your local law enforcement. And that's going to be your first step. If they're unable to help you, you can always reach out to the FBI as well. But again, this is a Texas penal code thing, so you'd want to try to get in Texas, especially if you're in Texas. If you're elsewhere, I mean, you got to report it to whoever you can, because like we talked about before, I mean, this is something that could be very harmful to your reputation, and you didn't even do it. So the first thing to do would be to go to local law enforcement.
I would imagine it's difficult, if not impossible, to get the image taken down. Do you have any recommendations for that? Notify the platform or the hosting service?
Yeah, and you know, my parents told me when I was younger, you know, be careful what you post on the internet, because once it gets on the internet, it's kind of there forever. Don't think I'm the only one who was told that at some point in their life. So, I mean, there's really no good option for eradicating it from the internet. But I think, like you said, you're going to the platform and letting them know that it exists, that it has to be taken down, that it's that it is a deep fake, that they didn't have permission to post it. I mean, I think those are great first steps, and just trying to take care of it as it goes. But as far as erasing it completely, I think that's, again, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible.
You know, when you talked about people's photos being posted without them even knowing it, that really resonated with me, because I don't even have a Facebook page. And yet when you Google my name, you can find hundreds of photographs of me all over the place without me having had anything to do with having posted them, because I don't post photos on the internet.
I took a class in law school. Still, I remember to this day, it was called Privacy in the Law. We talked about this issue of, if I take a photo of you and I place it on Facebook, does Facebook even have a privacy duty to me? Because we have no user agreement. And it is something that's always stuck with me. So even when people are trying to take photos of me, I'm like, please don't. I just don't, again, this with this deepfake thing too, it's like, how do you protect yourself? I think there's really not a good answer to that question other than to be vigilant that if it happens, you try to take it down as quick as possible.
How can our listeners follow you and the work that you do?
Yeah, so we are on LinkedIn, Saputo to Texas Criminal Defense. Our website is also Saputo, SAPUTO.law. We post a lot of different articles about laws that are coming out and updates in the laws on our website and on our LinkedIn. And that's probably the best way to get in touch with us.
Nick, it's really been a pleasure chatting with you today. Is there any aspect that we didn't cover that you'd like to mention?
No, I think we kind of covered it. I mean, like I said, this is a real big problem, and I appreciate you guys having me on to talk about it. I think awareness is key here to keep people from, as much as they can, becoming victims and being aware of it, so that if they do spot it, they're able to take care of it quickly.
Well, Nick, thank you so much. We wish you the best of luck, and we'd like to stay in touch with you about any future developments in Texas law.
Sounds good, ma'am. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.